From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I've always thought of Passover as a celebration of liberation. And liberation can never be just the Jews, because there's nothing free about being by yourself in some sort of country in battle. The only way to fight for liberation is to fight for everybody, and in this case, the Palestinians.
On the third evening of the Jewish holiday of Passover, Jewish Voice for Peace holds a protest seder outside the New York immigration offices after ICE seized another Palestinian Columbia University student with a green card. Meanwhile, President Trump met with Salvadoran President Nayib Bukele as Trump defies a Supreme Court order to return a Maryland resident wrongly deported to El Salvador.
How long do we have to answer this question from you? Why don't you just say, isn't it wonderful that we're keeping criminals out of our country? Why can't you just say that?
We'll get an excerpt of the meeting, along with response, and an update on the elections in Ecuador, where business magnate Daniel Noboa was reelected president, his challenger contesting the results. Then to the dark money game.
Supreme Court rolled back rules on campaign finance.
Citizens United said corporations can create a super PAC.
Now, corporations could fund elections with unlimited amounts of cash.
One way you could look at it is that it's a fair fight. Another way is that both parties are corrupt.
When it comes to the power of big business, the fix seems to be in.
We'll speak with director Alex Gibney of the HBO two-part series that premieres tonight. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Trump administration stepped up its defiance of a Supreme Court order to return a Maryland father removed to El Salvador as a result of what Trump officials called an administrative error. Kilmar Abrego Garcia was illegally transferred from the U.S. on March 15th and imprisoned without due process inside SECAT, the notorious Salvadoran megaprison known for torture and other human rights abuses. On Monday, President Trump welcomed the Salvadoran leader, Nayib Bukele, to the Oval Office in the White House to personally thank him for accepting some 300 people flown out of the U.S. since mid-March, Abrego Garcia among them. Speaking to reporters from the Oval Office, Bukele, who's called himself the world's coolest dictator, said he doesn't have the power to release Abrego Garcia.
I don't have the power to return him to the United States.
But you could release him inside El Salvador.
Yeah, but I'm not releasing. I mean, we're not very fond of releasing terrorists into our country. We just turned the murder capital of the world to the safest country in the Western Hemisphere, and you want us to go back into the releasing criminals so we can go back to being the murder capital of the world? And that's not going to happen.
During Monday's meeting, President Trump said he wants to transfer some violent criminals who are U.S. citizens to El Salvador, adding, Attorney General Pam Bondi's, quote, studying the law. Trump was caught on a hot mic telling Bukele, quote, homegrown criminals are next, adding, quote, you're going to need about five more places, unquote. In Maryland, protesters marched through downtown Baltimore Monday.
This could happen to anyone. I mean, we need to worry about Kilmar Abrego Garcia. But if he can be disappeared into a prison like this, just taken off the street by an administrative error, that could happen to any citizen. That could happen to any person. And President Trump would just say, oh, I can't do it. So I believe that fascism is here in America. I don't believe there is a rule of law anymore. And I think everybody needs to wake up and get out in the streets.
We'll have more on the deportations and removals of immigrants from the United States after headlines. President Trump's ordered the military to take control of a narrow strip of the U.S.-Mexico border spanning some 2,000 non-contiguous miles from the Pacific Ocean to New Mexico. The land transfers, an attempt by the Trump administration to skirt federal law prohibiting U.S. troops from being used in domestic law enforcement, including as immigration agents. Meanwhile, the ACLU reports the Trump administration's planning to dramatically expand immigrant detention facilities including opening new immigration prisons in 10 states across the Midwest and West Coast. The plans were brought to life thanks to a Freedom of Information Act request. In a statement, the ACLU warned the expansion would, quote, further the Trump administration's dystopian plans to deport our immigrant neighbors and loved ones, unquote. Last week, the New York Times reported ICE is requesting new contracts worth $45 billion for for-profit prison companies, including Geo Group and CoreCivic, for the construction and operation of new jails. Immigration authorities Monday detained Columbia student Mohsen Madawi, a green card holder from Palestine. He was arrested in Vermont when he appeared for what he was told would be a naturalization test. Madawi had previously expressed fears the appointment, which came earlier than usual in the typical naturalization process, could end up being a trap, and made contact with Vermont's three members of Congress to notify them of his concerns. All three condemned his detention on Monday. Like Mahmoud Khalil, Mohsen Madawi helped lead Columbia University campus protests against Israel's assault on Gaza. He was interviewed on 60 Minutes in December 2023.
To be anti-Semitic is unjust. Is unjust. And the fight for the freedom of Palestine and the fight against anti-Semitism go hand in hand, because injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere.
Here in New York, hundreds of members of Jewish Voice for Peace and others protested outside the offices of Immigration and Customs Enforcement Monday in Foley Square, the third night of the Jewish holiday of Passover, as alarm spread over the seizure of Mohsen Madawi.
My name is Bridget Bissonnette, and I have a great deal of family that means a great deal to me, who are Jewish. And, you know, the Jewish principles are very much about liberation for all people, and that this is a movement, and this is not a movement that we could be deporting. This is not a movement that involves hate. This is not a movement that involves violence. So Passover is about the liberation of people, and we stand here for all people to say, not ever again, not anyone.
The Trump administration said it's freezing $2.2 billion in federal grants and $60 million in contracts to Harvard University after the Ivy League institution defied Trump's order to eliminate all DEI initiatives and further crack down on Palestinian rights protests, including reporting international students to federal authorities. Harvard President Alan Garber wrote in a letter to the school community Monday, quote, the university will not surrender its independence or relinquish its constitutional rights. No government, regardless of which party is in power, should dictate what private universities can teach, whom they can admit and hire, and which areas of study and inquiry they can pursue, he wrote. In Gaza, Palestinian health officials say the confirmed death toll from Israel's assault has topped 51,000. More than 10,000 others are missing under the rubble and presumed dead. Over the past 24 hours, Israeli attacks killed at least 17 Palestinians and wounded 69 others. Among the dead are displaced children and parents who were blown up as they sheltered in tents in the Al-Mawasi area of Khan Yunis.
At around exactly midnight, a missile fell on this tent where women and children were sheltering. We were surprised when it hit. There are a number of martyrs, children and women, from the tents. This area was considered safe based on the instructions of the Israeli army, but we were surprised to find that this area is not safe. There is no safe place in the Gaza Strip.
Earlier today, negotiators with Hamas said they're looking at a ceasefire proposal submitted by Israel to Egyptian and Qatari mediators that includes new demands for Hamas to disarm. A Hamas spokesperson told Al Jazeera that demand was, quote, not acceptable to even hear, unquote. In Sudan's western Darfur region, the UN reports attacks by the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces killed at least 300 people in refugee camps over the weekend. The victims included children, as well as 10 humanitarian aid workers from Relief International Sudan. The RSF claimed on Sunday it took control of Zamzam camp. Some 400,000 additional people are believed to have been displaced in the area just over the last few days. The surrounding area of El Fasher is in the midst of a famine affecting some 637,000 people. Today marks 2 years since the devastating civil war erupted between the Sudanese army and the RSF. Aid groups are warning of a spiraling humanitarian disaster with some 13 million forcibly displaced, widespread reports of sexual and ethnically motivated violence, and a worsening hunger crisis. This is Sean Hughes of the World Food Program.
All these challenges are coming at a time when resources for humanitarian response globally are reducing. We know that it is not possible to stop a famine with food alone. You need health care, you need water, you need sanitation. So the whole response needs to be well supported in order to be able to turn this around and stem the tide of famine.
Foreign ministers are gathering in London today to discuss a diplomatic path towards a ceasefire in Sudan. The U.S. State Department official who oversaw the dismantling of USAID has left the agency after less than 3 months on the job. Under Peter Morocco's watch, over 80% of the U.S. Agency for International Development's programs have been canceled and the bulk of its staff fired. The cuts have already led to deaths in some countries, as health experts warn many more are to be expected due to cuts in essential services, including vaccines and other preventive health care. Last week, the World Food Program called U.S. cuts to emergency food assistance, quote, a death sentence for millions, unquote. In related news, the White House has asked Congress to claw back $9.3 billion of previously approved funding to USAID, public broadcasting, and other programs. That includes $1.1 billion in federal funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a taxpayer-supported company that provides matching funds to broadcasters, including NPR, PBS, and community radio and TV stations. In a statement, the White House accused the broadcasters of spreading, quote, radical woke propaganda disguised as news, unquote. Republican leaders are expected to take up Trump's request for a rescission bill, which needs only a simple majority to pass when lawmakers return from a two-week recess. On Monday, the White House barred Associated Press journalists from covering Trump's Oval Office meeting with El Salvador's president, despite last week's court order forbidding the Trump administration from punishing the AP for refusing to rename the Gulf of Mexico. Meanwhile, Trump has demanded that the FCC revoke CBS's license and impose fines after 60 Minutes aired segments critical of President Trump. Here in New York, jury selection got underway Monday in a retrial of a case brought by former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin, who sued The New York Times and its former editorial page editor for libel. The Times argued in court its editorial falsely linking Palin to a 2011 mass shooting was an honest mistake that was corrected quickly. Employees of the Internal Revenue Service are bracing for mass layoffs, with the Trump administration's reduction of force plans affecting roughly 100,000 IRS workers expected to take effect by the end of the week. The Washington Post reports the cuts could eliminate nearly a quarter of the tax agency's workforce, including the elimination of the Office of Civil Rights and Compliance. An analysis by the humanitarian charity Oxfam America found cuts to the IRS could help the wealthiest taxpayers avoid an additional $30 million in taxes per day on average. Today is the deadline for filing personal income taxes. One IRS worker told CNN, quote, there's going to be a huge backlog, probably worse than it was during COVID, unquote. And Mark Zuckerberg took the stand Monday to defend Meta's dominance in the social media landscape as a highly anticipated antitrust trial kicked off in Washington, D.C. The case was brought by the Federal Trade Commission, which alleges Meta, the parent company of Facebook, created a social media monopoly when it acquired Instagram and WhatsApp. If Meta loses the trial, it could be forced to sell off those platforms. Meta's been under renewed scrutiny in recent weeks as a whistleblower book from a former Facebook public policy director has made international headlines. Meta moved to block the author of Careless People, Sarah Wynne Williams, from promoting her book in the United States. But Meta's efforts to silence Wynne Williams did not prevent her from testifying to a Senate panel last week. Among other things, she revealed how Meta worked with advertisers to target teenage users, including with weight loss and other such products, if users displayed signs of body insecurities. She also detailed Meta's use of censorship.
I witnessed Mehta work hand in glove with the Chinese Communist Party to construct and test custom-built censorship tools that silenced and censored their critics. When Beijing demanded that Facebook delete the account of a prominent Chinese dissident living on American soil, they did it, and then lied to Congress when asked about the incident in a Senate hearing.
Beautiful.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
On the third evening of the Jewish holiday of Passover, Jewish Voice for Peace held a protest seder outside the New York City immigration offices after ICE seized yet another Palestinian Columbia University student with a green card. Mohsen Madawi, a co-founder of Palestinian Student Union at Columbia with Mahmoud Khalil, also a Palestinian green card holder just like Khalil. These are some of the voices from Monday's night's protest, including the lawyer who represents Khalil and also the Tufts University graduate student Remesa Özturk, who was taken by ICE agents who were masked last month in Somerville, Massachusetts, just outside Tufts. But we begin with a member of Jewish Voice for Peace.
Free Mahmoud! Free them all!
Free Mahmoud! Free them all!
Come for one! Face us all!
Come for one! Face us all!
My name is Marianne Pita. I'm here with the Jewish Elders, part of the JVP. I've never been more proud to be Jewish. I've always thought of Passover as a celebration of liberation. And liberation can never be just the Jews, because there's nothing free about being by yourself in some sort of country in battle. The only way to fight for liberation is to fight for everybody, and in this case, the Palestinians.
Come for one! Save us all!
Come for one!
One of Mahmoud Khalil's tireless attorneys, a law professor at CUNY and the founder of CLEAR, a vital legal clinic that challenges the U.S. security state, Ramzi Qasem.
My client, Rumesa, shared with me and my fellow lawyers representing her that when she was taken by ICE from her campus in Tufts, in the video that I'm sure you've all seen, and she was whisked across state lines by men in plain clothes in an unmarked van. One of these men turned to her, and he said, "We are not monsters." He said, "We're just doing as we're told." And so I want to contrast that message with the second message, which is a message of gratitude from Mahmoud, from Yunsar, from Rumesa, and I'm sure all the others whose names you know. The message of gratitude for all of you, because you exemplify the grandest Jewish tradition, the truest Passover tradition. You have stood in solidarity with the Palestinian people as they have faced a genocide. You've stood with Mahmoud, with Rumesa, with Mohsen, as they face abduction and detention. You're standing with Yunsar as she continues to fight to remain free, because she is still free. And for that, they are deeply, infinitely grateful for all of you.
To our dear friend who has inspired millions around the world with her conviction and love, the co-founder of Empower Change, Linda Sarsour!
I'm here to say I pray for you all to have a blessed Passover, and just to show my gratitude and at any chance that I get to come and say thank you to you directly, I'm going to do that. In Islam, thanking people is thanking God. And I thank God for you every single day for being on the front lines and saying to this administration, to the one before, and to the Netanyahu administration, not in our name.
My name is Abby Stein. I'm a rabbi here in New York City. I want to talk about Miriam, the cup of Miriam, which is just a cup of water. A tradition that has been added relatively recently, but is very important to so many of us as a feminist tradition. I will say as a queer person, as a queer tradition, but most importantly right now, I think about water. And I think for everyone here, I don't have to tell you what water means to Palestine and to Palestinians, and what occupied water, for the lack of a better term, looks like. I spent this summer in Palestine for a month and saw how that looks like, how you can tell whether something is a settlement or something is an actual Palestinian home based on whether they have access to national water or if they have to collect their own water. So water really is a symbol of occupation and oppression, and for us, it is a symbol of liberation. Yes. At the same time, water, Miriam, feminism, and queer liberation is too often used to control people, whether it is the Israeli government and intelligence services threatening gay and lesbian and LGBTQ Palestinians to expose them, so to speak, if they don't cooperate, or just using us, trans Jews and LGBTQ Jews, as an excuse why they keep killing people, while I have so many queer Palestinian friends who, before we can talk about liberation, just want to live. So right now, as we celebrate Pesach together, as we keep water, as we keep Miriam, as we keep our feminist foremothers, as we keep our queer elders throughout history in mind, this is what Pesach is: liberation for all, whether it is land, water, people, and each and every one of us at home and abroad. Thank you.
That last voice, trans activist Rabbi Abby Stein. Hundreds with Jewish Voice for Peace and others held a protest seder outside New York City immigration offices on Monday. When we come back, we'll see a part of President Trump's meeting with Salvadoran President Nayib Bukele in the Oval Office, along with the Trump, some of members of the cabinet, as Trump defies a Supreme Court order returning a Maryland resident wrongly deported to El Salvador. Stay with us.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest. We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes. We who believe in freedom cannot rest. We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes. Until the killing of black men, black mothers, sons, is as important as the killing of white men, white mothers, sons. We who believe in freedom cannot rest.
Ella's song by the Resistance Revival Chorus, singing at Monday's Liberation Seder in New York City. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we turn to President Trump's unusual Oval Office meeting Monday with President Nayib Bukele of El Salvador, during a long back and forth with the press at which key Trump administration officials and advisors were also present, President Bukele flatly refused to return Kilmara Borrego Garcia to the United States, the Maryland father who was wrongly deported, sent to the notorious Salvadoran prison CECAT. In a tense exchange about Borrego Garcia, several members of Trump's cabinet and team also weighed in. And the message was clear. Despite last week's unanimous Supreme Court ruling that the U.S. government should facilitate Abrego Garcia's return to the United States, President Trump and his cabinet insisted they are not required to do so. We're going to begin by playing this astounding exchange. During the back and forth, President Trump turns to Attorney General Pam Bondi, Homeland Security Advisor Stephen Miller, Secretary of State Marco Rubio. It begins with a question from CNN's Caitlin Collins.
Go ahead. Let's hear the question from this very low-rated anchor at CNN.
Do you plan to ask President Trump to help return the man who your administration says was mistakenly
Which one is it?
The man who was mistakenly deported to El Salvador.
Well, let me ask Pam. Would you answer that question?
Sure, President. First and foremost, he was illegally in our country. He had been illegally in our country. And in 2019, two courts, an immigration court and an appellate immigration court, ruled that he was a member of MS-13 and he was illegally in our country. Right now, it was additional paperwork that needed to be done. That's up to El Salvador if they want to return him. That's not up to us. The Supreme Court ruled, President, that if, as El Salvador wants to return him, this is international matters, foreign affairs, if they wanted to return him, we would facilitate it, meaning provide a plane.
So will you return him?
You are doing a great job. Thank you. Wait a minute. Could you just also respond to that question? Because, you know, it's asked by CNN, and they always ask it with a slant. Because they're totally slanting, because they don't know what's happening. That's why nobody's watching them. But would you answer that question also, please?
Yes, gladly. So, as Pam mentioned, there's an illegal alien from El Salvador. So, with respect to you, he's a citizen of El Salvador. So, it's very arrogant even for American media to suggest that we would even tell El Salvador how to handle their own citizens as a starting point. As two immigration courts found that he was a member of MS-13, when President Trump declared MS-13 to be a foreign terrorist organization, that meant that he was no longer eligible under federal law, which I'm sure you know, you're very familiar with the INA, that he was no longer eligible for any foreign immigration relief in the United States. So he had a deportation order that was valid, which meant that under our law, he's not even allowed to be present in the United States and had to be returned because of the foreign terrorist designation. This issue was then, by a district court judge, completely inverted, and a district court judge tried to tell the administration that they had to kidnap a citizen of El Salvador and fly him back here. That issue was raised to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said the district court order was unlawful, and its main components were reversed 9-0 unanimously, stating clearly that neither Secretary of State nor the President could be compelled by anybody to forcibly retrieve a citizen of El Salvador from El Salvador, who again is a member of MS-13, which, as I'm sure you understand, rapes little girls, murders women, murders children, is engaged in the most barbaric activities in the world, and I can promise you, if he was your neighbor, you would move right away.
So you don't plan
but
to ask
the Supreme Court's asking to...
And what was the ruling in the Supreme Court, Steve? Was it 9-0?
Yes, it was a 9-0...
In our favor.
In our favor, against the district court ruling, saying that no district court has the power to compel the foreign policy function of the United States. As Pam said, the ruling solely stated that if this individual, at El Salvador's sole discretion, was sent back to our country, that we could deport him a second time. No version of this legally ends up with him ever living here because he is a citizen of El Salvador. That is the president of El Salvador. Your questions about it, per the court, can only be directed to him.
Can President Bukele weigh in on this? Do you plan to return him?
Well, I'm certainly not suggesting that I smuggle a terrorist into the United States, right?
How can I
return him to the United States? Like, could I smuggle him into the United States or whatever? Of course, I'm not going to do it. It's like, I mean, the question is preposterous. How can I smuggle a terrorist into the United States? I don't have the power to return him to the United States.
But you can release him inside El Salvador.
Yeah, but I'm not releasing... I mean, we're not very fond of releasing terrorists into our country. I mean, we just turned the murder capital of the world to the safest country in the Western Hemisphere, and you want us to go back into the releasing criminals so we can go back to being the murder capital of the world? And that's not going to happen.
Well, they'd love to have a criminal, you know, released into our country.
I mean, there's a fascination.
They would love it.
Yeah.
sick. These are sick people. Marco, do you have something to say?
Yeah, I mean, Stephen Ireland, I don't understand what the confusion is. This individual is a citizen of El Salvador. He was illegally in the United States and was returned to his country. That's where you deport people, back to their country of origin, except for Venezuela, that was refusing to take people back or places like that. I can tell you this, Mr. President. No, the foreign policy of the United States is conducted by the President of the United States, not by a court. And no court in the United States has a right to conduct the foreign policy of the United States. It's that simple. End of story.
And that's what the Supreme Court held, by the way, to Marco's point. The Supreme Court said exactly what Marco said, that no court has the authority to compel the foreign policy function of the United States. We won a case 9-0, and people like CNN are portraying it as a loss, as usual, because they want foreign terrorists in the country who kidnap women and children. But President Trump, his policy is foreign terrorists that are here illegally get expelled from the country, which, by the way, is a 90-10 issue.
Well, Mr. President, you said that if the Supreme Court said someone needed to be returned, that you would abide by that. You said that on Air Force One just a few days ago.
How long do we have to answer this question from you? Why don't you just say, isn't it wonderful that we're keeping criminals out of our country? Why can't you just say that? Why do you go over and over, and that's why nobody watches you anymore? You know, you have no credibility. Please, go ahead.
President Trump, Trump's security advisor, Stephen Miller, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, Attorney General Pam Bondi, and Salvador's President Nayib Bukele all responding to CNN's Caitlin Collins on the wrongful deportation or removal of Maryland father Kilmar Abrego Garcia to El Salvador's notorious SECOT prison. Last week, Democracy Now! Spoke to Abrego Garcia's lawyer, Simon Sandoval Moschenberg, who laid out the facts of his client's case.
He was first arrested by ICE in 2019 when he was working as a day laborer in front of a Home Depot. There was this anonymous tip, this confidential informant, combined with the fact that he was wearing a Chicago Bulls hat, that as far as ICE was concerned, was more than enough to label him a gang member. When he was first detained by ICE, he had a preliminary hearing, and the immigration judge essentially said, well, I don't know what's going on. We've got this, we've got this confidential tip. I can't be satisfied. I don't know what's going on, so I'm going to deny his release. So the judge essentially ordered that he continued to be detained during his immigration proceedings. But then he had a trial, right? And he won his trial. The judge ordered him relief from removal, ordered that he could not be deported to El Salvador, granted him withholding of removal. And the government, the Trump administration at the time, didn't even bother to appeal, right? They just sort of said, oh, all right, that's fine. They released him from detention and they gave him a work permit. And he's been working, which he's renewed ever since. And he's been working legally now as a sheet metal worker apprentice on a legal work permit ever since. So to the extent that they've got these allegations against him, they're not even sort of contemporary allegations. They're 6 years old.
That's Simon Sandoval Moschenberg, the attorney for Kilmar. We turn now to talk about the Salvadoran President Nayib Bukele's meeting in the Oval Office with President Trump and the cozy relationship he has with the administration. Bukele, the man who likes to call himself the world's coolest dictator. We're joined by two guests. Joining us from Washington, D.C., Naina Gupta, the policy director at American Immigration Council. Her most recent article for Just Security headlined "The Missing Due Process for Gang Allegations." And from Mexico City, we're joined by the award-winning investigative journalist Jose Alvarez. He is a Drop Site News contributor, has recently reported on El Salvador, and in a minute we'll talk with him about the elections in Ecuador. But we're going to start with Naina Gupta. Can you respond to this astonishing White House meeting?
Yes, thanks so much for having me. What we saw yesterday was political theater and a set of administration officials lying to the American public. To be clear, Donald Trump and his administration can absolutely bring home Mr. Abrego Garcia. That is well within their power and authority. ICE has deported thousands of people wrongfully in the past. The agency does have a process to bring people back. I have worked on cases where the agency has immediately brought people home where they have admitted it was a wrongful removal, as the agency has done here. And the idea that the president cannot do this is a lie. Now, It's true, of course, that the president and executive branch have wide discretion and latitude when it comes to matters of foreign policy and national security, but that power is not limitless. And this is an administration now that has violated an immigration court order that prevented Mr. Abrego Garcia's removal to his home country of El Salvador. They are violating a Supreme Court and federal district court order that have required the administration to facilitate Mr. Abrego Garcia's return. This is the Trump administration violating the rule of law and violating due process. And they're doing that by cozying up to President Bukele, who has a track record of also violating the rule of law and human rights in his country. And it is a dangerous and cruel tactic that the administration is using here.
And Nina Gupta, I wanted to ask you, the administration obviously is claiming that because they've declared MS-13 a foreign terrorist organization, that this now becomes an issue of foreign policy of the United States, not just of immigration. But this whole issue of whether Abrego Garcia was ever judged to be a member of MS-13, what do you know about that? Because we had his lawyer say, put out his position a few days ago.
Right. Look, the Trump administration has never proven that Mr. Abrego Garcia is a member of MS-13. Mr. Abrego Garcia had an immigration court hearing where that issue was not meaningfully litigated. In this country, we believe in a right to a fair day in court. No, you cannot disappear somebody to a foreign country, to a prison in a foreign country, based on mere allegations or sham allegations. Unfortunately, there is a history in the Department of Homeland Security of using weak and flimsy evidence of gang affiliation as a basis to deport people, particularly men from Latin America. In this instance, the Trump administration has taken that to its extreme. They have removed a person in violation of multiple court orders at this point to a foreign prison based on really no evidence. That was not the main issue in his case. He is not a member of MS-13. And if the Trump administration says otherwise, they should have to prove that in a court of law.
And can you talk about the ACLU lawsuit back in 2017 that led the Trump administration to release over 30 children and teenagers from ICE detention after it was revealed that the government's evidence of gang affiliation was essentially non-existent?
Yes. So, again, this is not the first time the Trump administration has pulled this kind of sham and flimsy evidence to deport people or detain them and weaponize our U.S. immigration laws. In the first Trump administration, there was a lawsuit that the ACLU filed on behalf of over 30 young adolescent men who'd been accused of being members of gangs. This was based on evidence of tattoos, and evidence in notoriously flawed gang databases that are based on mere allegations as basic as this young man was seen in the same area where there is a lot of gang activity. That evidence was so flimsy and unsubstantiated that the federal court in that ACLU case said, in fact, that some of those young men should just be immediately released from immigration detention, and others, at the very least, needed, as a first step, a day in court for the government to actually prove those allegations, for that evidence to be used, for that evidence to be fairly brought in a court of law.
I wanted to ask you about another point before we go to the drop site investigation and to how this meeting took place. And that is Trump's comment in the Oval Office yesterday that he wants to send violent criminals who are U.S. citizens to El Salvador, adding Attorney General Pam Bondi studying the law. He was caught on a hot mic. You have to listen really carefully, telling President Bukele, homegrown criminals are next, adding you're going to need about five more places. But in this clip, in the Oval Office, President Trump's talking about it openly.
We always have to obey the laws, but we also have homegrown criminals that push people into subways, that hit elderly ladies on the back of the head with a baseball bat when they're not looking, that are absolute monsters. I'd like to include them in the group of people to get them out of the country, but you'll have to be looking at the laws on that, Steve, okay?
You mentioned that you're open to deporting individuals that aren't foreign aliens or are criminals to El Salvador. Does that include potentially U.S. citizens fully naturalized Americans?
If they're criminals and if they hit people with baseball bats over their head that happen to be 90 years old, and if they rape 87-year-old women in Coney Island, Brooklyn, yeah, that includes them. What, do you think there's a special category of person? They're as bad as anybody that comes in. We have bad ones, too. And I'm all for it because we can do things with the president for less money and have great security. And we have a huge prison population. We have a huge number of prisons, and then we have the private prisons, and some are operated well, I guess, and some aren't. But he does a great job with that. We have others that we're negotiating with, too. But no, if it's a homegrown criminal, I have no problem. Now, we're studying the laws right now. Pam is studying. If we can do that, that's good. And I'm talking about violent people. I'm talking about really bad people. Really bad people. Every bit as bad as the ones coming in.
So, Naina Gupta of the American Immigration Council, can you respond to what Trump has just put forward? That U.S. citizens could be sent to the prisons of El Salvador. Naina Gupta, if you could respond, I know your IFB just dropped out, very quickly, to President Trump proposing U.S. citizens could be sent to El Salvador.
Yeah, this is just the president playing a dangerous game here. He is testing the limits of his authority. He's testing the limits of United States rule of law, and he is flirting with the idea of sending U.S. citizens to a foreign prison. Right now, U.S. citizens, to be clear, are not at risk of this. But if the Trump administration gets away with violating multiple court orders and refusing to return Mr. Abrego Garcia, that will be an emboldening moment for the president. That will mean the president feels emboldened and has the right in his mind to take actions like the one he's threatening in this moment of political theater that we saw yesterday in the White House.
So we want to bring Jose Olivares into this conversation. If you can comment quickly, before we talk about your investigation of Ecuador and the elections, to how this all happened, this meeting between Bukele and Trump taking the immigrants and now this proposal of U.S. citizens to Salvador prisons, and also the role of Eric Prince, the notorious former head of Blackwater, and his role behind the scenes setting this all up. He's back in the United States now that Trump is president again.
That's right. Thank you, Amy. Yeah, so it's been a long time coming, these negotiations between the Bukele administration and the Trump administration. What we've seen is that in the months even leading up to the elections, we saw Eric Prince visiting El Salvador and touring these terrorism confinement center, this prison, and negotiating with the Bukele administration. And it seems likely that that's when the original idea was proposed to send immigrants detained in the U.S. to this notorious prison in El Salvador to be held by the Salvadoran government. So what we saw is negotiations also between the Trump administration, high-level negotiations between the Trump administration and the Bukele administration right as soon as the Trump administration took power. And they were able to negotiate a deal in which the Trump administration pays the Bukele government $6 million to detain all of these immigrants that are being expelled to this prison in El Salvador. But as part of the deal, we also saw a very secretive kind of maneuver by the Trump administration with Bukele. Just for some very brief context, in 2019, the Bukele administration negotiated with top leadership of MS-13. Now, this top leadership is called the Ranfla Nacional, and they're known as the sort of board of directors of MS-13, this top leadership of the gang. And Bukele administration officials were entering prisons to negotiate with these top MS-13 leaders. Now, as part of the deal, MS-13 was able to kind of keep some territorial control. Some of these leaders were released from prison. But at the same time, in exchange, MS-13 agreed to reduce the violence in El Salvador, reduce the number of murders, but also they agreed to mobilize their forces to support Bukele's political party for the 2021 legislative elections. Now, these elections were won overwhelmingly by Bukele's political party, which allowed him to consolidate power even further. But a year later, in 2022, this pact between MS-13 and the Bukele administration essentially fell through. And we saw Bukele put in place his state of exception with these massive prisons, rounding up thousands of people and putting these alleged gang members in these prisons. But as a result of the state of exception, the knowledge, the information about this pact, this original pact from 2019 between the Bukele administration and MS-13, it's an incredibly embarrassing thing for the Bukele administration. So he's been wanting to kind of, keep tight any sort of information that could be revealed about any potential links that his government had with MS-13. Now, there are two major indictments in New York accusing the Rampla Nacional of various narco-terrorism and terrorism crimes. But in those indictments, they specifically mention these negotiations, this pact between the Bukele administration and MS-13. Now, what we found out, according to some documents from the Department of Justice that were first accessed by El Faro, which is an excellent Salvadoran news organization, is that on March 11th, the Trump administration dropped all charges against one of these top MS-13 leaders. His name is Cesar Humberto López Larios. And on March 15th, as part of this initial flight of expulsions with the Alien Enemies Act, this man, this top MS-13 leader, was sent to El Salvador, essentially handed over to the Bukele administration as a gift, essentially saying, here you go. Thank you for letting us use your prison. Now, one of these top MS-13 leaders who could potentially speak in open court about the links between the Bukele administration and MS-13, here you go. He won't get to speak in open court anymore because all of his charges have been dismissed. And so it kind of shows kind of another layer of these kind of behind the scenes, top level, high level national security negotiations between the Trump administration and Bukele's government.
Well, Jose Olivares, we want you to stay with us. And Naina Gupta, we want to say thank you so much for being with us, policy director at the American Immigration Council, as we move to Ecuador. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we turn to Ecuador, where President Daniel Noboa won re-election in a runoff vote Sunday, according to preliminary results.
This event has been historic. The victory has also been historic, a victory of more than 10 points, a victory of more than 1 million votes, where there is no doubt who the winner is. And it is based on perseverance, struggle, work of each of the members of this team that seeks this new Ecuador.
But Noboa's leftist rival, Luis Gonzalez, the successor of former President Rafael Correa, is challenging the official results.
One of the exit polls gave us victory. None showed a difference like the one we are seeing at the Electoral Council. None. Therefore, I report before my people, before the media, before the world, that Ecuador is experiencing a dictatorship. We are facing the worst and most grotesque electoral fraud in the history of the Republic of Ecuador.
Daniel Noboa is a business magnate, heir to a banana industry fortune, who's made cracking down on crime his main priority. He's been condemned for skirting legal norms in the process, including declaring a state of internal armed conflict to more easily deploy the military. On the eve of the election, he declared another state of emergency, barring protests and authorizing warrantless searches. For more, we're still joined by Jose Olivares, investigative journalist and Dropsite News contributor, where he had a recent piece headlined Dramatic Video from Widow of Slain Candidate Rocks Presidential Race in Ecuador, confirms Dropsite investigation, in which he shared this video posted on X by Veronica Saraos, the widow of Fernando Villavicencio. She talks about her husband's assassination and the subsequent attempt to frame the political party of the former President Rafael Correa for the murder.
Soy Veronica Saraos.
I am Veronica Saraus. I want to denounce to the country and the international community an act of cover-up between the Attorney General Diana Salazar and the President Daniel Noboa, who are allowing complete impunity for the assassination and magnicide of my husband, Fernando Villavicencio, in August 2023, just days before the first round of elections in the last elections. I cannot and must not remain silent.
For more, we're going to Jose Olivares, who's joining us from Mexico City to discuss this dramatic video and the presidential race in Ecuador. Jose, if you can respond.
Yes, just very briefly. So in 2023, Fernando Villavicencio, this anti-corruption candidate who vowed to take on the drug and criminal organizations in Ecuador, was assassinated in the lead up to the elections. And following after that, we saw people, supporters of Villavicencio, come out and blame and essentially say that Rafael Correa and his political party were responsible for the assassination. Last year, Ryan Grimm and I at Drop Site News, we received over 1,500 leaked chats showing from within the Attorney General's office, showing that essentially the Attorney General knew exactly probably who was responsible for the assassination of Fernando Villavicencio. However, she let this lie, this rumor, run that Correa was responsible for the assassination. And it was done with political motives, right? And so now we're seeing the widow of Fernando Villavicencio come out publicly days before this election saying, listen, the Attorney General, Diana Salazar, and Daniel Noboa are conspiring, they're politicizing my husband's death, and essentially blaming Correa and delaying the investigation so that Daniel Noboa could have some sort of benefit in the lead up to his election, which he won on Sunday.
And Jose, we only have about a minute left, but could you talk about the visit recently of Eric Prince, a Trump ally who founded a mercenary company, Blackwater, to Ecuador, where supposedly he was providing law enforcement and the military the tools and tactics to combat narco gangs?
That's right. I mean, Eric Prince's visit to Ecuador was not just to sort of provide some sort of security structure or infrastructure or training to Daniel Noboa's armed forces. He was also there actively campaigning in favor of Daniel Noboa. Now, what's interesting is that we're seeing how Daniel Noboa is cozying up to the Trump administration. He was there front and center when Trump took power during his inauguration. And we're also seeing how Daniel Noboa is requesting that the U.S. government send special forces, send the U.S. military into Ecuador to also help fight in this drug war that Daniel Noboa launched last year. And we're seeing also how Eric Prince is very happy to make a deal with Daniel Noboa to provide training, to provide services to the armed forces as they engage in this, you know, drug war that has been plagued with allegations of human rights abuses by the armed forces.
Jose Olivares, we want to thank you for being with us. Journalists with Drop Site News will link
thank
to
you.
Your pieces at democracynow.org when we come back, the dark money game. I'm the son of Rachel Love, the Jesus of Suburbia, the Bible Love, not a theater love, only steady, united love. Not a popper riddle lad. Now I never died for that. Jesus of Suburbia by Green Day. On Saturday, the band performed the song at Coachella Music Festival and changed the lyrics from running away from pain when you've been victimized to running away from pain like kids in Palestine. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show with a new documentary series premiering today on HBO. Alex Gibney is the Academy Award-winning director of the HBO original The Dark Money Game.
In Mexico, it's a bite. In China, it's tea money. In America, it's called campaign finance.
There's a whole political world out there that runs on dark money.
When elected public officials deal with business interests, corruption, and bribery take over.
dark money led to the biggest case of political corruption in the history of Ohio.
In 2019, there was an investigation involving Matt Borges and Neil Clark. Neil had been one of the most powerful lobbyists in the history of the state.
Ready to f*** people over.
That recording with Neil Clark and undercovers, those were critical to connect that dotted line.
Every politician's got to have somebody that is the hitman.
The FBI asked me to essentially spy.
You're not, like, trying to set me up here, are you? That would be bad for both of us, but it would be worse for you.
And I thought, what is he going to do?
This was a organized conspiracy on a massive scale. But I fear this case is not a one-off example.
Dark money has heralded a new era of vast corruption.
If corporate America was going to reassert its power, it had to create a counter-revolution and take political power back.
We had a little Bible verse. The wealth of the wicked is laid up for the righteous. So let's baptize the billionaire's money.
The Supreme Court rolled back rules on campaign finance.
Citizens United said corporations can create a super PAC.
Now, corporations could fund elections with unlimited amounts of cash.
One way you could look at it is that it's a fair fight. Another way is that both parties are corrupt.
When it comes to the power of big business, the fix seems to be in.
A tiny group of people have bought an inordinate amount of influence.
People with money will always have an advantage. Always.
Money has a way of changing the rules.
For more, we're joined by Alex Gibney, Academy Award-winning director of this new two-part series, The Dark Money Game, an HBO original premiering tonight, 15 years after the Citizens United Supreme Court case. I want to thank you so much for being with us in these last few minutes as you feature Jane Mayer, the great New Yorker investigative reporter, her book called Dark Money. Talk about what's critical for people to understand today as your two-part series premieres, The Dark Money Game.
I think what's critical to understand is that our country is being run by a small group of people who have an enormous amount of money, and they dominate our politics. It's almost as if bribery has become utterly legalized. It's pay to play. It's quid pro quo. And unless we stop the system of money in politics, we're done, because then our lives will simply be ruled by the people who have the most money.
And Alex, how do these films relate to your earlier work, in particular, The Crime of the Century on the opioid crisis?
Well, it was doing a film on the opioid crisis that made me understand that one of the reasons there was such an anemic response to literally the intentional poisoning of America by a few corporations was because so many people in Congress were being paid off to look the other way, to focus on the needs of their donors rather than on the needs of their constituents. So it was that anger that led me to investigate this. We found an extraordinary story in Ohio that's literally quid pro quo corruption, and all the people on the FBI wiretaps are saying it's good now because of Citizens United. And then we tried to look back at how we got to this place by looking at the corruption of the Supreme Court. So, you know, and I was inspired, as you say, by the great work of Jane Mayer, who's in the film.
And in terms of the what you're hoping people will do, especially this coming out on the 15th anniversary of the Citizens United case.
Yes. I mean, I hadn't originally intended for that to be the case, but nothing could be more apt, because Citizens United is the single most damaging decision the Supreme Court has come up with in the last 15 years, because it's destroyed our democracy. And we need to understand that in order to get our democracy back, we have to reinvigorate our laws, as many states are doing, in order to be able to end this system of essentially legalized corruption.
Alex, want to stay with you? We want to stay with you and post online our second part at democracynow.org. Alex Gibney, Academy Award-winning director of the new HBO original series, The Dark Money Game, premiering tonight. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.